part of the Netziv's approach to Chesed was that the mitzvah of Chesed makes sense, and yet we do it also because what? It's a mitzvah of Hashem, you have to do it. Meaning even a mitzvah that's like a mishpat, that's rational, that makes sense, we do also because you have to, even if it didn't make sense. Yes or no? Why? The Netziv says, A, you get more schar, right, we discussed. B, because Hashem's standards are higher than human standards. And if we did things only because they made sense, then it wouldn't go far enough. Hashem demands higher standards from us. Rabbi Soloveitchik discussed a very similar theme in his writings. It's this page in the booklet, I guess page 2, where the Rav is discussing the idea why we view Mishpatim as Chukim as well. It isn't a contradiction to the Netziv, it's just a different angle of the Netziv. So what we're going to do now is read together and discuss, I think it's a major yesod, that the idea that even mitzvos that are Mishpatim, mitzvos that make sense, we do them also because they are what? Also because they are Chukim as well. Got the idea? Do you see how it connects with the previous idea of the Netziv? So what we're going to do now is not directly related to Chesed, but it's very, very much related to life. And I think it's important to do. It's a different, non-contradictory, different angle on viewing mitzvos that are mishpatim as chukim as well. Right here, we have it here. This is from Reflections of the Rav, Volume 1. Reflections of the Rav, there are two books out there by Rabbi Beis Din, Zecher Livracha. He wrote up the Rav's Torahs in easier to understand English. The Rav wrote and spoke often in a very highly intellectual way. For example, Only Man of Faith is very hard to understand. If you take a class in it, it's easier. If you don't have a class in it, so Reflections of the Rav, Volume 2, the first two essays is like an easier version of Only Man of Faith. So if you want to be exposed to Rabbi Soloveitchik's hashkafas on things in a relatively straightforward way, these are the books to start with. Reflections of the Rav, Volumes 1 and 2. Remember the shiur on the Rav Yaakov Vina being the first Jewish grandfather from Parshas Vayechi? Remember that? That's Volume 2, Essay 1. That's where I saw that. Before I heard the tape, that's where I saw it. Okay, let's read. It says here at the top of the page, general chukim seem to be irrational, and if not for the divine imperative, we would never observe them. We assume a divine purpose and value, but we cannot fathom them. The mishpatim, on the other hand, reflect cultural and humanistic considerations. That's what we think. Yet the force of the divine command applies to both, demanding observance and unqualified commitment. The question is, why? Why do the mishpatim need the support of the idea of chok? That's what the Rav is going to explain now. When the Torah talks about chukim and mishpatim, it mixes and matches. So it's clear in the Torah that just like you view mishpatim, just like you view chukim as mitzvos we do, whether we understand them or not, so too mishpatim are mitzvos we do, whether we understand them or not. Yeah, but we understand them. Why does the Torah indicate that we have to view mishpatim as chukim as well? Let's read the third paragraph. Why, we may ask, is it not enough for the mishpatim to be intellectually motivated? Why the need to add a chok, a non-logos dimension? I think logos means logical. To guess. A non-logos dimension to social laws which conscience itself dictates. If you ever try to read Halachic Man, that's the Rav's, it's probably his second heaviest sefer in Torah philosophy. His heaviest sefer is Halachic Mind. But Halachic Man. So he uses the word ontic and ontological many times in the first 25 pages. I've read Halachic Man several times. I still don't know exactly what ontic or ontological means. And I still understand the book pretty well. In other words, if the first 30 pages, if you don't get it exactly, you pick up after page 39 and you really can jump in. But anyway, I'm sorry, it's ontic and ontological. It's still all over the place. I don't know what it means. Whatever. I wonder what the original Hebrew, it was written in Hebrew originally, I wonder what the original Hebrew word for ontological was. Okay. Let us continue. You know, some in Hebrew, you know, some English, some words don't have translations in Hebrew so well. I once threw up, give a shiur, he was quoting, Hegel has this thing, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. You ever heard? Hegel has this approach. So he said, there's a tesi, there's the antitesi, and there's the synthesi, because, you know, there's no Hebrew word for thesis. That's the best you can do. Okay, apparently. Apparently, here we go. This is a major yisod in life. Apparently, reason is not a reliable guide, even with respect to mishpatim. There are borderline situations which confuse the mind, and consequently it finds itself helpless in applying its moral norms. Since our intellect must weigh pros and cons, and is slow and deliberate in deciding, society starts to nibble away, that's a beautiful phrase, at the edges of marginal borderline problems. Life must be lived! And before our logic, before I made an opinion, society will have already weakened all restraints. Permissiveness will have replaced orderliness, and the immoral in man will have emerged triumphant. What the Rav is going to say here is two related points. One, there are some borderline cases of mishpatim which humans have a hard time dealing with, and Hashem tells you yes or no. That's one point. But there's another point, and that is that it's natural that human standards for morality change. They change little by little. Permissiveness, I'll give examples. Permissiveness seeps in little by little. And even if originally the standards were really strong, little by little, the standards change. That's what he says here. The borderline problems. Life must be lived. Permissiveness will have replaced orderliness. Society starts to nibble away at the edges of marginal borderline problems. Now, he gives a few examples. For example, the mind certainly condemns murder. This is particularly true of killing of a young working mother who leaves behind orphan children. But does this abhorrence of murder also apply when the victim is an old, cruel, miserly woman who in the eyes of society was a parasitic wretch, as in Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment? The Rebbe was a strong speaker. May we murder her in order to save a young girl from the clutches of degradation? May euthanasia be practiced to relieve the elderly of terminally ill or further suffering? Here the logos hesitates, is uncertain, and imparts no decisive guidance. We can easily rationalize in either direction, and no external norm is compelling. As a mishpat, a social norm, murder may at times be tolerated. As a chok, the prohibition against murder is clear and absolute. In other words, A, these cases are fuzzy, they're hazy. B, over time, society might change. And it does change about these things. Euthanasia 60 years ago was thought to be the worst thing in the world, and now, you know, it's still considered usher and legal in America, but now people are already discussing it. It's very old. I don't know. That hasn't changed yet, Baruch Hashem. But there is a slight difference already in how the world perceives. That's the example he gives, euthanasia. The next example he gives is abortion. Talks about abortion. Maybe kill an infant? No, certainly not. The logos in the Mishpat proclaim. But a fetus in the womb confuses the intellect. Is this also murder? Or does one become a human being only upon emerging from the womb? And he starts to discuss, and this is what happens. Society, little by little, changes its norms. So the Rav here is saying, and the idea is as follows. The Netziv focused on that Hashem's standards are higher. The Rav's focus is A, sometimes society's standards are fuzzy and hazy, and the Torah is clear, but B, more sharply, a sharper point, sometimes society's standards change. And if we, this is the punchline, if we viewed all mishpatim only as mishpatim, and we did mishpatim, it's a long punchline, and we did mishpatim only because they made sense, then eventually the standards would change, because what makes sense changes. So we do mishpatim because Hashem said so. And that's why, even mishpatim, and so the standards don't change. Even the mishpatim, the standards don't change. What's called murder, these don't change. I'll give you just an example how society, you know, just so, I'll give you three examples. Tennis, baseball, and television. So, tennis. Have you ever seen movies, old playing tennis in the 20s and 30s? The men all wore pants, and the women were dressed more or less like Beis Yaakov girls. Yeah, I mean, that's how they play tennis. They had long skirts on. I mean, go to Wilmington in the 1920s and 30s. It's interesting. We're 60 years later. 60 years in the big picture of life is not such a long, long time. And a complete change in what's considered the norm of how to dress when you play professional tennis. That's a good example. How people dress when they leave the house in general. Baseball games. If you go to a baseball game nowadays, you always have some characters who want to get on television, and they go there in 20-degree weather, and they paint things on their bodies, and the Cubs, C-U-B-S, or one guy paints C-U, and they do nutty, crazy things. If you ever see old movies of baseball games in the 40s and 50s, suits and a hat. It's incredible. Most men, in the 40 years ago, they went to a game wearing a suit and a hat. That's how they went to baseball games. Because in the 50s people held baseball was a chashuva sport. Now, no, it's because people dressed differently in the old days. People went outside. People felt you're leaving your home. The whole world's going to see you. You should dress in a more mechubad way. It's a striking contrast. The way people dressed going to baseball games versus now is completely different. Society in the last 50 years, this is not what the Rav said, has slowly nibbled away at what's considered acceptable behavior. And the last example is television. I'll quote my mother. I have a wonderful mother, Kanana Harva, and she's a wonderful mother in general. And she's also very sharp about things, very sharp. Let's see, just in general, you should know there's a whole yisod in life called nonverbal communication. It's all you saw in life. Rob Orlov talks about it in his books a lot. It's about, let's say, for parenting, even for friendships. You communicate verbally, and you also communicate non-verbally. Verbally is, I love you, I like you, I talk to someone. Non-verbally is like a hug. A hug is classic non-verbal communication. So Rob Orlov talks about that very often. It's important to have a lot of non-verbal communication in your life with your kids as well. Because, some parents are more verbal, some are less verbal, and kids pick it up, kids notice. And he says you should try to do these things. Nonverbal communication. He gives examples. A hug is a classic one. You go over and give your child a hug. Stop. That builds the relationship, it builds the warmth. It's a beautiful idea. Rav Orlovich writes, he writes that Rav Reuven Feinstein, Shlita, his father was one of the busiest people in the world, Rav Moshe Zatzal. And he said that we knew our father loved us. Why? Because Rav Moshe had very little time during the week for his family, because he was always so busy, running around, passing shilohs, doing a million things, running a yeshiva, running Klal Yisrael. He said, but during the winter, our father would get up early and lay our clothes over the radiator 20 minutes before we got up to go to school. So when we got up to get dressed for school, we had warm clothes to put on. That is classic non-verbal communication. Rav Moshe is screaming at the top of his lungs, I love you, to my kids, without having time to spend hours and hours with them. When you're a parent, you want to try to find these types of non-verbal communication. And it's a yesod. It's a yesod in being a spouse. It's a yesod in being it's a big part of being a parent. You try to find things. If you know your child likes something. So as Stam, I know you like this type of book, so I saw this book in the bookstore, and I decided to buy it for you. One of my kids likes paper airplanes. So my wife found this book, like the ultimate guy making paper airplanes. He's in heaven, he's making paper airplanes. And I mean, like 200 airplanes all around the house now. It's hysterical, all over the house. And he has them organized on his desk, and over here, he can't touch them. Anyway, that's, okay. So I mentioned this. Why? Because I know my mother, Kanahora, she loves me. When she made our lunches, she gave us two Hershey Kisses, me, she never forgot, every single day for lunch with my lunch. But a better example, I came to Israel back in the Stone Age, before the age of email. I was in Israel in the 50s, and back in the 50s, before email, there was whatever. And when I was in Israel, think about it, before email, And I was in Israel for 6 years. I was in Yeshiva in Israel for 6 years. I have wonderful parents for another reason, 6 years. And my parents' friends say they're crazy, but I say they're wonderful. It depends how you define, you know, staying in Israel for 6 years. Anyway, I was in Israel for 6 years, and some of my parents' friends. And I received, on average, 5 airmail letters a week for 6 years from my mother. You know those little blue airmail letters, you know, like, well, I don't know if you know them anymore because they're Stone Age. You know, they fold over. And my mother would just write this, you know, what's going on at home? Melissa did this, so-and-so, my siblings, whatever. You know, nothing fancy. And it was like a joke. Oh, Ginsburg, you have another letter. You always have a letter. And it wasn't a joke. You know what it means to do that? And she did it with all my siblings. She said it took her maybe 10 minutes, maybe, I don't know, maybe less, every single day. And it's screaming at her kids, I love you. Without having to, you should know, it's a non-verbal communication. It has an impact. It has an impact over time that it, you know, sinks in. Okay, anyway. Right. So I'm quoting my mother. So my mother talks about, so TV. So 25, 30 years ago, my family, we'd watch Motzei Shabbos. We'd watch Prime Time together. My parents would sit there and we'd watch whatever was on the... We'd also play bridge. My family plays bridge. I don't know if you know, bridge is like chess with cards. It's a very advanced, fancy card game. No, my family, no, we're actually pretty good. My grandparents play, and my parents play, and my nephews play now. My kids want to learn to play now, because when they're in the house, they want to play it. Anyway, so it's like, my family plays bridge. Whatever, we actually once went to a bridge tournament in Baltimore. The United States National Bridge Tournament was in Baltimore. Now, every time there's a national bridge tournament, they have like the amateur section. Anyone can go in and join. You go and you join the tournament. So we went in the amateur section, the four of us, my parents, my brother, and I. And we came in tied for second place in this group. So therefore, if this matters to you, it might matter to your parents, I have 3.25 master's points recognized by the United States Bridge Association because we came in tied for second place. And we didn't even know how to play bridge in a reasonably good way. All right, you don't know. And you should know, the team that beat us cheated. Now to explain that, you have to really know bridge very well to explain how exactly it happened. Our kids are, and we, like in our family, it's a big joke that my brother and I knew exactly how they cheated, but like, we were too meek to make a big deal out of it. Okay, anyway, so that's a side point. TV. So we're watching TV now, and prime time. Now, 25 years later, my mother tells me she's embarrassed if she hears that her grandchildren watch primetime television in America. I have siblings in the States. She's embarrassed. Because the difference, what's allowed now in prime time, is so different from what's allowed 25 years ago. It's incredible. 25 years, again, in the big picture of life, is a very small amount of time. And there's been this huge change. Like the size of the Grand Canyon, what is allowed on normal prime time television 25 years? I mean, my mother says, she says it's incredible. Well, that's what happens. Society nibbles away. Things that weren't allowed become a little more allowed, etc., etc. This is why we can't just view Mishpatim based on it makes sense. Because what makes sense? What makes sense, quote-unquote, changes over time. Because standards, societal standards, change. That's why the Torah has to have rules and regulations about how these things go. Because once it's based on what makes sense, it makes sense, of course don't kill, of course you dress appropriately when you leave the house. Yeah, but what's called appropriately? Society starts changing, what's called appropriately, and then who knows what's appropriate anymore? The Torah has standards. Chazal give us standards. You hear the vort? It's mamash, I think it's mamash emes. This is why we have to view mishpatim as chukim, because we have to remember, because if a mishpat is viewed as a chok, it's not going to change. You with me? Okay, those are the examples. I think they're all good examples. There are more than those. But tennis, baseball games, and television, whatever. It's a different world now than it was even 25 years ago. Okay, that's the road.